All right, welcome back, everybody. Hope everybody had a nice Rosh Hashanah. I'm sure it was different in many, many ways. But I will start with the following. I don't have the actual source of it. It's fascinating nonetheless, and I'm hopeful that over the next little while I will speak to enough people and find out what the real, I'd like to see it inside. But supposedly, a great sage, I may have shared this with you, the great sage by the name of the Chatam Sofer. Did I share this? Hey, fascinating. He lived about 150 years ago. And supposedly in one of his writings, he made reference to the fact that the year 5780, which was last year, was going to be historically a difficult and hard year. Which, interestingly enough, it played out to be. So why am I sharing that now? Is because there was an addendum to that. He also wrote that 5781, in contrast, was going to be an excellent year, was going to be a very good year. So part one has certainly been fulfilled. We're going to hope and pray that part two will also be fulfilled. I'm just curious as to the source of it itself. I know the Chasam Sofer is somebody who I put a lot of stock in, a lot of trust and faith in, love his Torah, was a tremendous leader in Europe for the Jewish people, but I'd like to see it inside in one of his works. So I'll continue to do my research. Okay. We are up to the ninth letter of the alphabet, the letter Tet. I'm going to quickly just pull it up so you have what do you call it? Where is my, here it is. All right, we'll make it a little, I'm going to share it. We're going to make it a little bigger. All right, that's good. Okay, give me 1 second, sorry. Let's share screen. Here it is, and voila. Okay, here we have, it's actually the first letter on the second line. This is the letter, let's make it a little bigger, zoom in, there we go. This letter right here is called the letter Tet. It is the ninth letter in the Hebrew alphabet. Just take a look at its form, take a look at something unique about perhaps its top, because we are going to make reference over the next little while to the form and to those funny looking, we'll call it a crown. But what is the letter Tet? So I've often shared with you, whenever we discuss the alphabet, we go ahead and we make reference to what is the Talmudic take on it. What exactly does the Talmud say about this? So we've quoted this before, that if Aleph Bet, meaning Aleph Bina, you continue to learn Torah. Gimel Dalet, for Gomel Dalim, you bestow kindness on the poor, meaning you have your relationship with God in terms of Torah. You have your relationship with people. Then the blessings of Hey Vav, God's name, is Zun. He will provide sustenance. That's the letter Zion. Then last week we learned about the letter Chet, which stood for, anybody? Anybody remember what the Chet stood for? Okay, maybe not.
That the connection between either two vavs or a vav and a zayin.
Good, but the letter chet. But the letter chet was standing for what?
The chuppah.
The chuppah. Okay. From the Talmud itself, we said that it was reminding us of
transcendence.
Transcendence, right? But the word was chayim, standing for life, correct, Jay? The male-female relationship, all that is true. But what's fascinating is that when we talk about, the Talmud says that not only will God provide zun, will he provide sustenance, and he'll provide life, and chayin was really the word I was looking for, providing grace that we will find in the eyes of others. But the letter tet stands for tov.
Tov. Good.
Good. In fact, the Talmud says that the Tet stands for Tov Umeitiv, the one who is good and bestows goodness. Somehow the letter Tet is associated with goodness. Okay, I can think of probably 5, 6, maybe 10 other words that start with the letter tet that don't have a good connotation. Why is it that the Talmud feels that the letter tet is associated with the word tov? Before you answer that, the Talmud actually talks about dreams. If you are into dreams and you love to know about interpretations and what they all mean, there's an entire section in the 9th chapter of the tractate Brachot that talks about dreams and what they mean and what they could mean, not what they do mean, but what they could mean. The Talmud says that if a person dreams about the letter tet, sees it consistently over and over, just strangely has dreams about the letter tet, it's a good omen. It's a good sign because tov, it will come your way. Goodness is coming your way. But it's the same question. Why is the letter tet associated with tov, with goodness? So I've shared this principle with you in the past and I'll continue to bang it home. When you have the first appearance of a word or a letter in the Torah, that is its primary source. So if you start at the very beginning of the Torah and you find the very first occurrence of the letter tet, what's the word that appears? Is the word tov, that God saw that the light was tov. God saw that the light was good. There's that association immediately. The very first occurrence in the Torah is tov. Okay, that's a nice idea, but it's got to go deeper. In contrast to the Talmud, there's another primary source called the Midrash. The Midrash actually says that the letter tet is not connected to the word tov, but in fact uses a different word. The word in Hebrew for mud, mud or clay, mortar, that's a better word, mortar. Clay, mud, mortar. In Hebrew, the word is tit, tet yud tet. Okay, that seems to not jive very easily with the idea of goodness. Mortar or mud is much more symbolic of the physical matter. It's something that you get stuck in. You get dirty. It's not something that you want. You know, they're up to that stage in my basement of where they're putting mud on the drywall, connecting all of the seams. Yay, thank God. But it's a mess. It's a royal mess. And when the guy is done with it, he's got like white splatters all over him from the mud. How can that possibly be good? It's foul. It's unwanted. But if you think about it, it's not hard to understand. What is the function of mud? I don't mean dirt that you add water to, but even back then when they didn't have the compounds we have today, what was its main function? What did you do with it? You built bricks with it. You built homes, you built structures. It was the glue, so to say, to allow you to build further. If you didn't have that mortar, you didn't have that mud, so you're stacking bricks or rocks, and with no effort whatsoever, it will topple. The function of the mud is as a building block for further growth, for greatness. And the truth of the matter is that therefore, the mud is really good. I understand you get dirty with it, and on the surface, on the externals, it seems like something not positive. But if you dig a little deeper and you recognize its true value, its essence, it's as good as it comes. The expression that's used over and over again when we talk about this word tov, good, from a Jewish and a Torah perspective, we don't look at the definition of good is what looks good on the outside. That's not a fair barometer of true goodness. You can have situations of where the hiddenness is really what's good at the core. That's finding the good, even within the hiddenness, is really the true goodness. If you were to spell out the word tet, right? If you were to spell it out, like we did for the word Aleph or Bet or Gimel. We spell it out with letters. So for Aleph, it was Aleph Lamed Fei, right? That spells the word Aleph. So if you spell the word Tet, it's Tet Yud Tav. Three letters. Tet, Yud is the next letter we'll get to, and Tav is the last letter of the Hebrew alphabet. So Tet, Yud, and Tav. When you add those letters together, the numerical value is 419. Ooh, what's the significance of that? Nothing in and of itself. However, we've shared this also in the past. When we talk about numerology, when we talk about the number system in Judaism, there's the actual number itself. So for example, in this word Tet, you have the letter Tet itself, which is the number 9. The next letter is Yud, which is 10. But remember, in a different format, we ignore zeros. So for all intents and purposes, the letter Yud has the value also of 1. Okay, so Tet is 9, Yud is 1, and the last letter Tav, which is 400, is essentially 4. So you have 9 plus 1 plus 4 for a grand total of 14. The number 14 is very significant in Judaism because it stands for the word Yad, hand. Yud, Dalet, hand, Yad. What's so significant is that when you want to find the good in things, what you're essentially trying to do is to find the hand of God even in the difficult times. In English, we call it the silver lining of a deep, dark cloud, of finding something positive. There is a truth to that, a tremendous truth. But from a Jewish perspective, we don't just call it a silver lining as if it just magically appears there. What we do is we seek to try to find the positive in what seems to be not so positive, because essentially we believe that God has a hand in all of it. And you're looking for the Yad. So if you want to ask me point blank, why is the letter Tet associated with Tov? Because it is the letter that is teaching us to look for the hidden good under all circumstances. Not just what is explicitly or obviously good, but even that which is hidden. I'll give you a couple of examples. The Talmud tells a story about a fellow who had a very strange name. His first name was Nachum. Nachum is not strange. There's a lot of people even today whose names are called Nachum. I have a brother-in-law whose name is Nachum. Okay? But his second name, so to say, he was known as Nachum Ish Gamzu. He was Nachum, the man of Gamzu. Okay, that's a little weird. He was a man of Gamzu. Well, Gamzu are two Hebrew words, which mean, Gam means also, Zu, this. Gamzu, also this. He was a man who no matter what happened in his life, he would always say, Gamzu litova. This too is for the good. I don't understand. I don't know why God is doing this, but I trust Gamzu. This too is also for the best. Everything that happened in his life. The Talmud tells a story that unfortunately, during the time of the Roman persecution, and they had taken over in terms of the land of Israel, soon before they destroyed the temple, the Talmud says that there was a decree against a certain Jewish community. And they felt, as the leaders of the community, they had to go see the Caesar himself in Rome to appeal this decree. And they talked among themselves who should be the appropriate leader to go. And they decided on this fellow named Nachum Ish Gamzu. He would be the one. So they took whatever valuables they had in the community and they filled a chest full of these precious items. Okay, it's not a quick trip. And he's traveling and it comes nightfall. In the old days, you really couldn't travel at night. So you stayed over in probably it was still a Motel 6 back then. Also, they left the light on for you. So he stays over in this particular inn. And what happens? He goes to sleep. Well, the owner of the inn had other guests there. And when Nachum gave the owner of the inn the chest to safeguard, well, It's not every day that a person comes with a chest and says, can you please put this in the local safe? So curiosity, sure enough, he finds, he opens it, and he sees all the precious gems. And he decides that he's going to go in cahoots with some of the other undesirables staying at the inn. I did tell you it was Motel 6. And they decide they're going to take all of the gems. They take all of the precious items, but they know that they can't just leave it empty because he'll know. So they fill it with dirt. They fill it with dirt, and they don't say anything. Nachum gets up the next morning, and he continues his journey. He takes the chest, and he travels, and he travels. Ultimately, he makes it to the Caesar. He makes it to the palace. The Talmud continues and says that he comes before the Caesar, and he wants to offer this tribute, this gift to the Caesar. And they open it up, and they're all excited. Oh, let's see what this gift is. And all it is dirt. The Caesar is furious, and he's ready not only to continue the decree against the community, but he wants Nachum and all of the Jews of the town killed. Until an advisor comes forward, parentheses, the Talmud says, the advisor was none other than Elijah the prophet, there, Johnny on the spot, end parenthesis. And the advisor says, but wait, maybe the Jews wouldn't send a gift like this of just dirt. That makes no sense. They would travel all this way to just make fun and mock you? That doesn't make sense. I'm willing to bet, he says, that this might be the famous dirt that Abraham, their patriarch, used in his battle. The Talmud says that when Abraham was fighting, if you know the famous story of the four kings versus the five kings, the four kings beat the five kings. It was really the First World War, long before the 1900s. And Avraham's nephew Lot is taken captive in that war. Long story short, Avraham single-handedly gets Lot back. He wages the war, and the Talmud says that Avraham, he took dirt from where he was and he threw it at the enemy, and miraculously they turned into spears and swords and killed the enemies. Okay, whatever the story is. This is what the minister, the officer says, hey, maybe this is that kind of dirt. The Talmud says that at that time, the Romans were waging a war on one of their fronts. One of their battles was against a particular country they were having no success in overcoming. So the Caesar decides he's going to test this theory. So he sends the chest of dirt to the front lines, and sure enough, they use it and they actually turn into swords and spears and they conquer that particular country. The Caesar's all excited. It's wonderful. Not only does he thank him, he refills the chest with all of his precious gems and sends him back home. Just as a postscript to the story, he stays over at the same inn. And sure enough, they asked him, what happened? How are you here to tell the story? He said, well, what happened? He says, well, this is what happened. I took the dirt. I didn't know that, but the dirt from this place is what came along. And of course, the innkeeper is so excited. He fills another chest, and he, the next day, goes visiting the Caesar, presents the same gift, unfortunately doesn't have the same miraculous powers, and he and his buddies are all killed. Okay, why am I telling you this? Because every step of the way, when Nachum found out, his response was, Gam zu Latova. This is for the best. I don't know the plan, but I believe wholeheartedly that it is always for the best. It'll work out somehow, some way. It itself was good. Why is this significant? Because when you have a perspective that what happens in your life becomes an unknown, I don't know why certain things happen, but I'm able to deal with it if I know and I trust Gam Zu Litova, that there is goodness found within. I'm not suggesting that I'm on this high level of Nachamish Gamzu. I'm by no means that way. But I will tell you that my wife and I have numerous times throughout the process of our basement, we have asked ourselves the question, why? Why do we need this headache right now? There's so many other things that we're dealing with. I don't know the answer why. But from my youth, I learned it from my parents. My wife learned it from her parents. That's the attitude. There's a good thing out of all of this. One day we'll understand. Maybe it's because we wanted or needed a new basement. And okay, insurance is covering a large percentage of it. Who knows? I'll never know. But Gamzu Latova was the attitude. We didn't freak out. We didn't go crazy. Okay, now I'm going crazy because it's taken 3 months. But in general, the approach is Gamzu Latova. I don't know why, but I do know and trust that it is good. Hidden within this event is goodness. If you look at the form of the letter Tet, it actually is, whoops, I got to share it again, sorry. It is, if you look carefully at it, you have almost as if there's something hidden within. All the other letters we had were clearly at the tops, all exposed, all very clear. This is the first one that has a little bit leaning inward because there's a certain hidden aspect. This is the idea of why the letter Tet means Tov, means finding goodness within. Perhaps that's even why it's related to the word mud, because ultimately it is for a good purpose. Seems unwanted, but if you can see it for what it really is in its essence as a building block for greatness, for growth, then yes, all of it really is for good. But here's where it gets even more fascinating. I share with you that the word Tov appeared in the very beginning of creation on the first day. But the truth is it appears almost every day of creation. On the first day, God said, God saw all that he had done. Right? Vayar Elokim et, everything was Tov. Ki Tov. Second day? Ooh, okay. Okay, it doesn't have it on the second day. But don't worry. On the third day, you get a double Ki Tov. It's good. Fourth day, Ki Tov. Fifth day, Ki Tov. But on the sixth day, something strange happens. God, when he finishes all of creation, he doesn't say it's Tov. He says it's Tov Me'od. It's very good. Oh, now we're talking. Now we're cooking. This isn't just good. This is very good. I can understand that. If my theory, not mine, based on this idea that Tov means good, that all of that's hidden, even within all of creation, no matter what comes, is all hidden for good, then it makes sense that at the end, when everything is completed, then he marks it not just with it, it's good, but ultimately it's very good. And in the end, we'll see how all of it was really all in essence good. I can live with that. Nothing shocks me there. Here's where we run into problems. Because if I had just left it here, everybody here would be, yay, good idea. I love it, Rabbi, great speech. The problem is that I'm lying to you. Because the Midrash actually on those words, on where God says at the end of the sixth day that it was Tov Me'od, it's very good, says the Midrash. You know what that's referring to? Your evil inclination. The Yetzer Hara. What? The Yetzer Hara, your evil inclination that gets you, that wants to tempt you to go in the wrong direction, to turn away from God, to not have a moral compass. Whoa, how can that be very good? Creation is good, and the topping on all of it is the Yetzer Hara telling you that it's Tov Me'od? Now we have a problem. Now we have a real problem. Houston, we have a problem. But I think you know the answer. What is the function of the Yetzer Hara? What is, at the end of the day, why did God create this angel, this creation that's there to tempt us to turn away and not follow God's command? What's it there for? It's there to challenge you to make a choice. You see, we are not Pavlov's experiment. We are not the little mouse. We're not the dog that if you condition us over and over and over again, we will choose the right thing. That's not who we are. As human beings, we were given free will. The definition of free will means you have two viable options. So that when you actually choose an option, that was your doing. If you don't have a Yetzer Hara, you don't have a pull in the opposite direction, then you're nothing more than Pavlovian dog. That's all you are. No choice. God creating a system where there's a Yetzer Hara, where there's a pull, there's a choice you need to make, is ultimately for your benefit. Because you will have succeeded and achieved what you needed to in life by specifically defeating that Yetzer Hara. His function is for your benefit. I know it sounds illogical, it sounds backwards logic, but it's not. If you don't have that yang pulling against your yin, then you don't have choices. The Yetzer Hara is tov ma'od, because everything in creation, yeah, there may be hidden goodness, but until you have the opposite pull, you're accessing that goodness is not your own choice. You need to have that choice. And therefore, tov ma'od, those challenges, those difficulties are ultimately for your good, for your growth, and for your benefit. That is what it stands for. So the ultimate tov is where you have to challenge yourself and choose, even in difficult times. I think to me, one of the most inspirational aspects of this whole corona is the fact that in the throes of all of it, there was so much engagement, both in terms of the classes, of people reaching out to each other, people stepping up to become heroes that maybe we didn't know. That potential that laid latent within the person became actualized. But that is the recognition of the goodness within. That's the letter Tet. Now, let's take this a little bit further. I feel like it's a challenge we face on a regular basis. And in the world in which we live in general, and certainly today, it's even more difficult. We view life through two lenses. Maybe that's why we have two eyes. Certain things we look at and we see the positive, and certain things we look at and all we see is the negative. In terms of events, in terms of people and actions. This is how we do it. And it's challenging in today's world. The Talmud understands that and it reflects so beautifully. You know, there's a blessing on everything. Judaism 101, right? We have a blessing on everything. We have a blessing on hearing good news. When you hear somebody has a child, you say, Mazel Tov. Well, that's true. But the one to whom the good news has happened actually makes a bracha. When a child is born, the parents have an opportunity to make a bracha. Yeah, Shechianu, right? That's your thank God for bringing us to this incredible day of having a child. But unfortunately, when we hear bad news, or what we call bad news, sad news, somebody passing away, we don't say necessarily, oh, blessed are you, God, yay. We find that hard to do. We make a different blessing. We say, Baruch Dayan HaEmet. Blessed is the true judge. The Talmud says that a person in today's world, today meaning the last 5,000 years, in the world in which we live, we are struggling with this dichotomy. On good news, we say, Hatova HaMeitiv. Oh, thank you, God. You are the one who is good and bestows goodness to others. But on sad news, we say, Baruch Dayan HaEmet. Blessed is the true judge. I don't understand. I can't be excited. I don't see the good in it. Why did so-and-so pass away? Why is so-and-so going through such a hard time? I don't see it, God. God says, okay, I understand. In today's world, you make two different kinds of blessings. For what you obviously see is good, so give me a blessing that you thank me for the good. And if you see things that are not in good light, Just recognize that I am the true judge. And even though you don't understand, you trust that I do. That's how we deal with it. But at the end of the day, the Talmud says, while we make two separate blessings now, ultimately, when Mashiach comes and all the pieces of our puzzle and all the questions we've had over the course of our history become answered and everything becomes crystal clear, there will be no need to say the blessing of Dayan HaEmet, which is just basically I throw up my hands and say, I don't understand, but I trust you do. We won't have to say that blessing anymore. On everything, we'll be able to look back and say, Hatov Vahametiv. All of it was really good. I didn't see it at the time, but I now do. That is the blessing that says that when we have that ability to be able to see the global picture, all the pieces that will fit into place, we'll see that ultimately it wasn't just I didn't know and I trust. I actually will be able to see that hidden goodness that was there. How do we do it though? It's easy in theory, but in practice, it's so difficult to be able to see that goodness. I once read a beautiful analogy that I think hits on it so beautifully. There's a fellow who comes to shul for the first time, right? Okay, some of us have this difficulty prior to Corona where we weren't going to shul and on any regular basis. You know, jokingly, they call you the two-time-a-year or three-time-a-year Jew. You go 2 days Rosh Hashanah and you go Yom Kippur and you've done your thing. But they talk about a fellow who's for the first time coming into synagogue. And he's watching, he's absorbing everything. And he sees the gabbai giving out the honors. He gives one guy in the back the first aliyah. And he goes into the third row on the left and he gives that guy a second aliyah. And then he goes to the other side and the third one and the fourth. And he goes all over the place giving out all the different honors. And he goes up to the gabbai, this guy, this newbie, this rookie, comes to the gabbai and he says, this makes no sense. Why don't you start row one, seat one, and give him the first one? And then next to him, I mean, just go in an orderly manner. Why? There's no rhyme or reason to what you're doing. This is so silly. The gabbai looks at him and he says, I'm sorry. How long have you been here? 45 minutes? You've been here an hour? And you think you figured it all out? Well, do you know why I gave the guy in the back the first one? Because he's the only Cohen in the building. He's the only one. He gets the first one. And that guy next to him, why didn't I just go in that order? It's because the guy next to him, he got one last week. Oh, and just skip and go to the next one? Well, he has Yahrzeit next week. He'll get one next week. And he explains why he gave each particular person the correct aliyah. You come here for the first time. You're here for 45 stinking minutes and you think you figured it all out? And you got questions? You think the system is broken? This is the analogy. We are on this world. We come late to the game. All of us on this call are already thousands of years late. We're showing up to shul already. We're at Ne'ilah. We're at Ne'ilah. It's the end of Yom Kippur already. And you know what? We just showed up. We missed Kol Nidre. We missed everything. And we don't understand? Okay, so I don't understand. And you got questions? God says, where were you when I formed all of this? Are you going to be here at the end when this is all over? If you're lucky, you're on this earth for 120 years in good health. If you're lucky. And you think you have questions? You think you don't understand? You're a guest in my shul, he says. That's our life, folks. Yes. We have questions, and they're legitimate questions, but you can't ask it on a specific incident as an individualized event. You're not seeing the global picture. You're missing part of the story. When you say the words, Gamzu Latova, this is for the good, it's not because you actually see the good necessarily. I don't know if I'm on that level. But what you're saying is God, you've been here since the beginning. You see the whole picture. You have the global perspective. I trust in you that you know the truth. You know what's good, ultimately. I don't. I'm just a guest here for a short period of time. Where this comes out so beautifully, my father of blessed memory used to tell us, I'm sorry, I'm hoarse. I taught for 2 hours before already today. My father used to say, if you look at the first blessing of Shmona Esrei, the first blessing of the Amidah, doesn't make a difference. Weekday, Shabbos, Yom Tov, Rosh Hashanah, they're all the same. The first ones are the same. There's a listing of different attributes about Hashem, different attributes about God. Baruch atah Hashem, blessed are you, Hashem, Elokeinu v'Elokei Avoteinu, our God, God of our ancestors, Elokei Avraham, God of Abraham, Elokei Yitzchak, God of Isaac, Elokei Yaakov, and the God of Jacob. And then we start listing. Hakel, you are the Almighty. Hagadol, you are the Great One. Hagibor, you are the Powerful One. V'Hanorah, you are the Awesome One. El Elyon, you are the Supreme Ruler. Gomel Chasadim Tovim, who bestows kindness on others. And we keep going down the list. So if you look at it just in that context, you have various adjectives. Almighty, great, powerful, awesome. And then you have two expressions. Kel Elyon, supreme ruler, followed by Gomel Chasadim Tovim, who bestows kindness. In most Sidurim, there's a comma between the two. He is not only the supreme ruler, comma, but another attribute is that he is bestower of kindness. My father said over, I think he got it from one of his teachers, but this was his mantra in life. He said, there's no comma between the two. Bestows kindness. How many times have we had the question on God? This is your kindness? This is what you dole out? I don't understand. Why are you considered so benevolent? Look at the troubles. Look at the horrible things that happen in our world. How can we call you the benevolent one? Gomel chasadim tovim. You bestow great kindness? I have a question. My father said that if you put the two phrases together, it makes sense. It's only because he is El Elyon, he is the supreme ruler who sees everything, can we honestly say that it is truly bestowing kindness. I am not the supreme ruler. I don't see the whole picture. It's only because he is as one, El Elyon, Gomel Chasadim Tovim. Since he is that supreme ruler and he sees the whole picture, in reality, all is truly Chasadim Tovim. Good, fair, honest benevolence. That's what it is. Putting those two phrases together. Okay, so let me wrap this up because we got to continue because this all has to connect to the number 9 at the end of the day too, which we didn't get to yet. What I want you to walk away with is as follows. The letter Tet is the word or the letter that symbolizes Tov, goodness. That's what it is. And again, looking at the form of the letter, it's descriptive of something hidden within. As we'll see next week, also God willing, we're going to tie it into the form. But it is even within the hiddenness, finding the good. How are we able to do that? Because we know and we trust that God knows what's good for us. Like we brought from the Midrash that Tov Ma'od, the ultimate goodness, is where we have the ability to grow and to be challenged and overcome those challenges. That makes us better. And in the end, was for our benefit. Seeing the letter Tet in a dream is foreshadowing perhaps goodness that is coming your way. Doesn't say it's going to come easily. You're going to have to do your part. But it is Tov. It is ultimately good. That's also the reason why the Medr says it's not only related to Tov, but also related to the word Tit, which means mud, the building blocks for growth. All of that fits into this. Okay. I'll leave you with the final which will transition us into next week, God willing. There are, if you were to look in a Torah scroll, okay, let me do it this way. We use the word parsha very, very loosely when we talk about, oh, what parsha is it this week? Right? You hear that all the time. What parsha? Between you and me, that's really not the correct word. The real word, if you want to talk about the weekly Torah reading, it's called a sedra. From the word seder, like you have Pesach, that which was ordered for this week. The whole conglomerate of what needs to be read for this week, as opposed to the order that's going to be for next week. The real word is a sedra. Where does the word parsha come from? So if you look inside any chumash, printed or in the Sefer Torah itself, there are breaks, what we'll call paragraphs. It's not really a paragraph, but there are breaks between sections within the same sedra. You may have 2, 4, 8, 20 different parshiot. Parshiot are the sections. For lack of a better word, I'll use the word paragraph, but it's not, it could be one sentence. But it is a dividing between one concept and another. Okay? In a standard text, between one parsha and another, the halacha demands that there be space. How large of a space? 9 letters. It's a blank space that you could theoretically write 9 letters in. That is the requirement between sections. 9 spaces. Why the number 9? Tune in next week when we explore how the number 9 fits into all of this, about finding the hidden good within and why it's specifically related to the number 9. Liz, question. You have to take yourself off mute.
I thought I did, sorry. Are they 9 vertical spaces or 9 horizontal spaces?
Horizontal.
Okay.
The letters run across the line. You finish the sentence. Skip 9 spaces and start the next one.
Okay.
As if you were writing more letters, but just leave that blank. If you don't move, I'll show you what I'm talking about. Okay. I'm just going to open up to her. This is a book that most bar mitzvah, b'nai mitzvah people use. It's a copy of what a Torah looks like. And you have on one side is the text without the vowels and one with the vowels. So if you just look at the page itself, you'll see at the very top line here, there's spacing. Then you have your paragraph and there's another spacing and then another spacing. And here's another. This is 9 letters right here. That's how the entire, almost the entire Torah is written, with those kinds of spacing between sections. That's really what a parsha is. A parsha is a section within a sedra. But everybody just refers to it as the parsha of the week. I don't know where it came from, but that's the technical term. So next week, we're going to start with the understanding or try to explain why this number 9 spacing is needed, why the number 9, and how this all fits into our idea. Any other questions? Fabulous. Okay. Great to have you all back. I will see you. Everybody have a, before Rosh Hashanah, you say you should be signed and sealed. Now you say the whole finishing, Gemar Chatima Tova. Everybody should have their concluding sealing of a good year. And everyone should have an easy and meaningful Yom Kippur come this Sunday night, Monday. And I will see you, God willing, back here on Tuesday at 8 p.m. Have a great one, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi T.
A pleasure.
Thank you. Yeah.